Hello, this is Patrick Miner, Patrick Miner's podcast, episode 41. Today's discussion is with the curator of a button museum in Muscatine, Iowa.
You know, we kind of chuckled about this being a button museum. And of course, one of the first questions we often get when people walk in the door is, why would you have a button museum? Why would you have a museum devoted to this? And what we hope to accomplish when people walk out the door here is to show them why it mattered, why it is interesting. And I think most people find that to be the case by the time they leave, because it was a big deal here. This town of, at that time, 12 to 15,000 people made 1.5 billion buttons a year, which was about a third of the world's total. So it was a big deal locally here, but also it's kind of a natural resource utilization story, a treasure story, as our previous director used to say, a national growth story, because this was one of the industries where they took a free resource, in this case, mussel shells from the river, and made it into a worldwide manufacturing operation. And that has environmental costs. And so we explore that a little bit too, because when you look at these buttons, they're obviously beautiful. And, you know, the mother of pearl is lovely. In some cases, they were kind of considered jewels. And indeed, pearls were one of the products that this industry showed up and people sought after. But the thing that we try to bring it back around to is that this was a living creature. These mussels, about 300 species at that time in the river, are now vastly reduced in terms of their numbers for various reasons. One of the big ones being 1.5 billion buttons worth taken out of the river every year. I like to bring it back around to these mussels. And so that's kind of an overview, I guess.
That's a great overview, and I'm going to now allow my guest to introduce himself.
Hi, good morning, Patrick, and good morning to your listeners. My name is Dustin Joy, and I'm the director of the National Pearl Button Museum in Muscatine, Iowa. We tell the history of the button industry, which was the dominant economic force in this town for about 50 years, starting in the 1890s. I got to this place of directing a museum in a rather non-traditional route. Prior to this, I spent 25 years in aviation. I was an airline pilot for a small regional airline for 22 years. That's basically my history.
So the river has a natural resource that builds an industry, the button manufacturing industry. Let's explore the fact that there's a natural resource.
Yeah, this industry, we usually credit one man to starting it, a guy named John Beppel. He was living in Germany, and he was an artisan, a craftsman, and one of the businesses that he was involved in was making buttons, and he had developed a process for doing this. He found that shells, especially the mother of pearl shells, were very good for this and made a very pretty product that people highly valued. He had trouble getting the freshwater mussels that he needed in Germany. He was using ocean shell, which he imported. Of course, there were a lot of tariffs as he had to import these shells from other countries. Tariffs started eating into his business, and he started looking for different alternatives. About that time, someone in the U.S., a member of his family, sent him a shell from a freshwater mussel from the Mississippi River. And he immediately identified that this was exactly the natural resource he needed for his project. And he took a great leap of faith and moved to the United States. And after moving around a bit here in the Midwest, he finally settled in Muscatine. And because of the nature of the river here, it was especially productive of freshwater mussels. And he set up a small business making buttons. Later, he was more of an artisan than businessman. And later, he kind of got pushed out of the business as more and more people realized that this was a free resource that they could get at a nominal cost and make quite a bit of money on, because especially early on, pearl buttons were a status symbol. They were almost like a piece of jewelry. If you had, our former director, Terry Eagle, always said, you know, if you had pearl buttons on your clothing, that meant you were successful. The inner lining of most mollusks has a layer called nacre. This is actually the material that pearls are made of. The mussel lines the inside of their shell with this material. It seals the shell and protects them from parasitic invasion. And yet, in the case of a pearl, if there's an irritant, they coat this irritant with this nacre, and that is what forms the pearl. Well, the inside lining of the shell is also lined with this, and if you've ever seen it, that, it's very beautiful. It's iridescent. It turns out, even down at the subatomic level, that this material is made from a type of calcium carbonate, that it's layered, and the thickness of these layers is coincident with the wavelength of white light. And so when viewed at a different angle, it gives all these beautiful iridescent colors. And so this is a really pretty material to make jewelry.
There are lots of different shells. Some or most might be capable of providing the pearl butt.
Yes. At that time, there were about 300 species of mussels in North America, at least 30, especially plentiful here. Most all of them had a beautiful iridescent inner mother-of-pearl layer of their shells. Some, obviously, because of their size and shape and curvature, lent themselves more readily to making buttons. Certain species, obviously, were much more preferred than others for this. And fortunately, again, for Beppel and people who followed after him, this area had plentiful. Muscatine was, I guess you'd call it, the mother church of the button industry. Ultimately, the muscatine industry reached out to about 19 states. As the supply of shells around here was depleted, they reached out to tributaries of the Mississippi and the Ohio and the Missouri. And rather than ship these shells to muscatine for processing, they would set up these regional blanking plants, not factories. And the main companies in muscatine had blanking plants all over this area, and then they would ship these button blanks up to muscatine to be further processed.
Okay, so we've got the river. We've got, I think you said, 300 different kinds of mollusks. We've got Mr. Beppel, immensely in muscatine. How many people do you think were involved in the manufacturing, distributing of the buttons at one time?
If you had a relative who lived in muscatine during that period, a father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather, probably somebody from their family worked in the button industry here. Just to give you some scale of this, one statistic is that starting in 1905, muscatine produced 1.5 billion buttons per year for several years. That's a rather abstract number, but if you do the math on that, and consider that, you know, the average button produced was about an eighth of an inch thick, that is something around 2,900 miles stacked button. And this is from a town which was about 12,000 to 15,000 people at that time. So I don't think it would be overstating the case to say most of the people in town were involved in this industry in some way. And that included men, women, and children. There's no doubt in my mind that this industry wouldn't have formed here without the Mississippi River. Again, this was the immediate source of most of the natural resource that they used making their button. If it hadn't been so prominent here, Beppel probably never would have settled here to get this business going.
Let's discuss the way these mussels were harvested and then how machined into buttons.
If you go down on the waterfront here in Muscatine, you'll see a statue about 20 feet tall of a guy standing in a John boat with what looks like a post hole digger in his hands. And in a very real sense, that's what it was, but he wasn't digging dirt. He was digging mussels out of the bottom of the river. And these long handles, he would push them down into the bottom of the river and then open them up. And the forks at the bottom would hopefully grab a mussel or two and bring them to the surface. So this was one way that people harvested mussels, not a very efficient way. They quickly discovered that there was a better way and a much more efficient way of catching mussel, and that was a braille bar with what they called crowfoot hooks. So if you picture a metal bar about 15 feet long, dangling from it a series of chains, evenly spaced every 4 or 5 inches, and at the end of a chain, a hook that really very much looks like a crow's foot. It has, or kind of like a treble hook if you're a fisherman. An unfortunate characteristic of these freshwater mussels, at least for them, is that they tend to sit in the bottom of the river with their shells slightly agape. And if anything contact the inside of their shell, they clamp down on it. Well, unfortunately for them, the clammers, as they were called, figured this out. And when you would drag this crowfoot hook along the bottom of the river, if it touched a clam or mussel, that mussel would close up on it, and you could pull them to the surface. And with a rig like this, and in one pass with a device like this, you could pick up dozens or maybe even hundreds of mussels in one pass. So this is how about 70% of the mussels were harvested. They would fill their boats up. When they got 100 or 200 pounds of shells, they would go up on the bank. A lot of these people would set up camps camps in the summertime. They would live in tents out there along the side of the river, and they would set up an operation there. When the people brought mussels in, they would be put in tanks and a fire lit underneath. They would heat them up until the shells opened up, and then they would cut them open and remove the inner muscle and soft tissue of the mussel and save the shells. All the time, they were also looking for pearls. About 1 in 100 freshwater mussels has a pearl in it. Now, these don't tend to be the nice symmetrical round pearls that you see with oysters, but they did have value as jewels, and when the shell buyers from the various muscatine companies would come around to buy the shells, they would also often make deals for the pearls, and there was a ready trade in the pearls as well.
Was there ever any use for the waste products, the inside of the mussel? Or was all that just thrown back into the river?
For the most part, it was exactly that. It was thrown back into the river. Later, as they started to study mussel reproduction and biology, they tried to find other uses for it. Some people tried to feed it to livestock, you know, use it as a fertilizer. It was dried and used as a fertilizer, but the vast majority of it just got pitched back into the river, to the extent that in some local areas it almost became an ecological problem of its own. To a certain extent, fish and other wildlife would consume it, but in the quantities they were producing it, it got to the point where it would foul the water in local areas there. But I'm glad to get back to the mussels, because probably to me the most interesting fact of this industry is that it was made from living creatures. These buttons, which are very beautiful, were living creatures, and very interesting ones too. If we just added an exhibit to our museum to study a little more this idea of this living creature called a mussel, and why it matters. These are creatures that live in the river, and they actually feed by filtering water. Fairly large mussel can filter 10 to 15 gallons of water a day. If you extrapolate that, millions or hundreds of millions, just their removal from the river really changed the ecology of the river. So the muscatine industry had a big effect on these living creatures and also the ecology of the whole river that we live on. Of these 300 species of mussels in North America, about 70% of them are either extinct or in a threatened status now. It's not simply because of the button industry, but that was a part of it. The nature of the Mississippi River changed dramatically in the 1930s when they started to build the lock and dams. It went from a free-flowing stream, which, as our previous director used to say, ran from bank to bank as a series of sloughs. In the 1930s, when they built the locks and dams, the Mississippi River became a series of impoundments. That certainly changed the nature of the environment for these mussels, and for some, it was catastrophic. Also, of course, as agriculture advanced and we started using more nitrogen fertilizers, runoff became a problem. It changed the balance of the river's ecology, with certain species and plants doing much better and others suffering. And mussels were one of those that suffered quite a bit. I want to mention the reproduction of these mussels, because it's fascinating. And to me, it's one of the most interesting stories, too, if we could just touch on it a little bit here.
I'm very interested. I never even thought about the reproduction of the mussel. Please tell us.
At the rate of 1.5 billion buttons per year, quickly people in this realized that this was going to be a problem long term, that this wasn't going to be sustainable. So a little bit too little, too late, the button industry and the U.S. government got together and they built the Fairport Biological Station about 8 miles upriver in the little town of Fairport. The idea was to study these mussels, try to understand how they live, how they reproduce, and with the goal of propagating mussels to replace what had been taken out of the river. This was a very interesting effort, and it filled a couple of needs. The industry hoped that it would save the industry long term. So the industry and the U.S. government went together to start the Fairport Biological Field Station in 1908. The purpose of this facility was to study mussels, try to understand how they live and reproduce, and ultimately to propagate them for replenishing the Mississippi River with mussels. They learned a lot, and one of the most interesting things they learned was about how these mussels reproduce. I think they always knew they were were filter feeders that they took in water, filtered out food and oxygen, and pumped that water out. But what nobody originally guessed was that mussels require a fish species as a host, parasitic host, for their reproduction. And if you think about it, it makes sense that this evolved over time, because mussels don't move very far. You know, in their lifetime, they may move, you know, a handful of feet from their original location. Some species, clams and oysters, hardly move at all during their entire lives. So to pioneer new areas and new promising terrain for mussel habitat, this system evolved where in the larval stage, these larval mussels called glochidia are injected into the mouth of a fish, and then they travel with this fish for a series of weeks or months to new locations, and then drop off and form a new colony wherever they drop off. Now, here's a creature that hardly moves very far. How exactly do they get their glochidia into the mouth of a fish? And isn't that wasteful? Well, it's a wasteful process. This is where evolution did another amazing thing, because many of these species have appendages as part of their mantle that have evolved to look like, amazingly, a little fish or little crayfish. And this actually lures the host species. Let's say there's a species called a plain pocketbook, a Lampsilis. She has a little appendage on her mantle that looks just like a tiny minnow. And when a largemouth bass, for example, which is a prime host for the Lampsilis, comes up to take a bite of this, she squirts a mouthful of glochidia, these little larval mussels, into the fish's mouth. Now, a lot of them are wasted, but there are millions of them, so some of them lodge in the gills of the fish, and they look like little traps, like little leg hold traps, and they clamp on to this gill tissue of the fish. And again, millions of them are wasted, but some of them survive and clamp onto this fish's gills. And a surprising thing happens. The fish's tissues actually surround the little mussel. And in the 2 or 3 weeks or a month or so that the baby clam lives in the gills of the fish, it's surrounded and protected by the fish's gills. And it travels to new areas of the river, hopefully a promising location. And when it's sufficiently developed, it drops off and forms a new colony. These very interesting adaptations to getting this accomplished are rather amazing. As I said, one species, her mantle looks like a little crayfish, and not only does it look like a crayfish, she will wiggle back in simulation of how a crayfish moves. Now, it's also, things have developed a kind of a problem, and one of the reasons that these species are threatened is because these adaptations evolved over, you know, millennia. And the river changed in a dramatic way in a short period of time. One problem with the lock and dams, for example, is that it affected the movement of certain fish species. There's a species of mussel, the Higgins eye, that relies on a fish called the skipjack herring. Well, this is a migratory species that moves up and down the river. When they built the 40-foot lock and dam at Keokuk, Iowa, it effectively blocked the migration of these fish up the river. Well, that made the Higgins eye especially endangered upstream of that area. So these systems of reproduction that evolved over thousands or millions of years were subverted over the course of 4 or 5 years by this development. So it's really fascinating, this reproductive strategy. And of course, it just shows you that some of the things which we consider advancements, the ability to ship goods and materials up and down the Mississippi River, sometimes have unforeseen consequences. And I think it behooves us to pay attention to that as we move forward. People are getting a little more enlightened about that stuff. I've been working on this exhibit with a fisheries biologist from Moline named Heidi Weber, and she's helped me a lot with the development of the exhibit, but also she was one of the spearheads of an effort to move some endangered mussel colonies near the site of the new I-74 bridge in Bettendorf. And that was important work, and that's one way that we're now paying more attention to these creatures that are below the surface and out of sight. But there's a magazine called The Iowan, and in this last issue, they had a very interesting article about mussels, and they talk quite a bit about what's happened in the Great Lakes with the zebra mussels and the quadras. These zebra mussels, you know, they were introduced in ballast tanks, dumping from freighters from overseas, and I wouldn't say they have no natural predators here, but they, you know, they're not natural here, so they have few predators. And they're very prolific. They have a slight more efficient method of reproduction than most of the native freshwater mussels here. And they have really taken over, especially Lake Michigan, a good case. And as we said, they're mollusks, they're mussels too, and they're filter feeders. One of the byproducts of this invasive species is clean water. But for a lot of other species, clean water is exactly not what they need. When I built this exhibit, one of my little ideas originally was that I would have an aquarium full of mussels so people could look at them. And a couple of the fisheries biologists told me, well, you know, this is pretty tough to do because basically mussels clean the water to get their food. And so if you have an aquarium that they can live in happily, it's probably going to look like a dirty aquarium. The same is kind of true of these zebra mussels in the Great Lakes. They made the water clean, but in a sense, it's too clean for a lot of native species there. Also, they're in the Mississippi River, too. You can go down on the beach here in Muscatine and find zebra mussels, and they're moving their way up what we call the Iowa Great Lakes, which is in the northern part of the state, and on up into Minnesota. They've moved upstream. So, yeah, it's a big problem, and it's a tough one to address. They're very successful species, and seen a lot of pictures of ebony shell mussel or something, which is a native species completely covered by zebra mussel. They actually use the native mussel as a substrate to grow on. And so, yeah, it's a big problem, and a lot of people are trying to think about what to do about it, but it's advanced so far in places like Lake Michigan that a lot of people are kind of thinking there's never anything that we can do to really address it properly. The thrust of our museum is on the button industry and how these shells were turned into buttons. So I'm happy to talk about that as well, of course. Because of the way they were harvested and maybe sat for a long time, sometimes they would build up supplies for the winter months when they couldn't harvest. These things would sit around and dry out. That was actually kind of bad news for production because this material, mostly calcium carbonate, would dry out and get brittle. And so when you try to machine it, it would chip. One of the machines invented by the Berry Company of Muscatine. They were really the innovators in the machines, and the machine would happen in about 20 seconds. And then this would be buttons more or less finished, would be dumped into buckets. They would be taken to a polishing area where there were big rotating drums. They would be put in there with some kind of abrasive sawdust and tumbled in there to give that nice natural luster, as they always said, was done. But then you had more or less a finished button. To me, one of the most tedious and terrible jobs in the button factory would be what came next. As you can imagine, since these shell buttons were made from, you know, dozens of species of clams of different sizes and ages, even once you've imposed this order and made a button out of this that all looked less than optimum, the big job at the factory, in my mind, was sorting these. And primarily women worked in this job. They would sit for 8, 10, 12 hours a day and look at thousands, maybe millions of buttons and sort them into as many as 15 different class based on damage to the shell, button crack, coloration, symmetry of the holes. So this tedious kind of mind-numbing job was done by some of these ladies for 10 hours a day. Before it was over, at the peak in probably the teens, maybe early 20s, there were 24 button companies in Muscatine. And most of them had a trajectory where they came up fast and adapted this technology and then kind of faded out. And of course, you know, at the end, there were only a few that were doing business. Surprising to most people, the last two button factories in Muscatine closed in 2020. That was the McKee Company and the Weber Company. Now, they had long since switched over to making plastic buttons. When they finally started developing some better plastics after World War II, you could roll out a sheet of this plastic substrate and punch thousands of buttons at a time out. Obviously, the economics of that were going to beat out this laborious process of catching mussels in the river and hauling them to Muscatine and turning them into buttons. And so fairly quickly, the plastic button industry came, the pearl buttons, and it faded out, and probably none too soon for the mussel population.
Does the museum have artifacts that also includes many of these machines we've been discussing?
Oh, yeah, we do. And it's, again, I think it's really, we have, again, Beppel's original machine. We have a number of the more advanced Berry machines. We have videotape from the 1940s of some of the more advanced machines built by the Smargy Engineering Company here, who also ran their own button factory on the side. And we have a Berry double automatic and a classifying machine. So, yeah, come here to Muscatine, pay us a visit, and I can show you all these things.
Is there a date or a month or at least a year that you claim is the very last button made in Muscatine?
Our video, which is kind of an interesting overview of the whole industry, I think it says that the Rhonda Bunder Button Company made their last button in 1963, I think. And by then, they were using imported ocean shells, too, for that process, because basically the mussel harvesting industry had collapsed by that point. A lot of people walk into our museum, they maybe saw an ad, or maybe they're just walking down 2nd Street in Muscatine, and they think, why in the world would you have a museum devoted to buttons? And I like to think when they walk out the door, they have an appreciation for this and why we're so excited to talk about it and tell this history. Again, the only word I can use for it is cool. We see this every day, especially with couples. You'd see the wife who may be interested in buttons or sewing, or maybe her grandmother collected an old jar of buttons and had it in their house, which was very common back then. And so she drags her husband in the door to see this museum that he obviously doesn't care about. And we like to think quite often she ends up dragging him back out the door because he becomes interested in the subject and the machinery and the history of these mussels. And I think we have a little something for everybody that will interest people who come to Muscatine. It's, again, and as our previous director always said, a national growth story. It's one of these so many stories we've had over and over again of heedless use of natural resources. These weren't bad people, but you know, when you're involved in something this big and this active and vital, you don't always think of the repercussions of it. And we learn this lesson over and over again, whether it's the gold rush or advancements in agriculture, we don't always consider all the ramifications. And that's certainly one of these stories here, this national growth story. Again, so many people, they don't realize how interesting this is until they get here. I didn't want to end this without talking about a lady named Veda Baker, who is our gift shop manager, but I call her our resident artist. And if you come to see us for no other reason, I would say come to see some of Veda's artwork here. She knows this history much better than I do, too. So if you come in, I hope you're here on a day when Veda's here. And again, I referenced Terry Eagle, who really made this place what it is. He and his compatriot, Angie Weikert, who kind of taught me the ropes when I came here, they gave me a firm foundation here to build on, and they were fantastic. So I can't say enough good about these folks and how much this museum wouldn't exist without them. Well, thank you very much for that, and thanks for asking me to come on. I always love to share this history, and we've talked about to come here to Muscatine and see it in person.
I have an interest in doing whatever I can for the ecological health of the world. Stories about Lake Michigan and these other things, ways I hope I'm contributing a little bit.
Every person who tells these stories affect the way other people think.